Hello and welcome to this emergency episode of the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and as all of you know, the Department of Justice released a redacted copy of the Mueller report to the public today. The day began with a press conference where Attorney General Bill Barr gave his own take on the findings, and an hour later, the report was released. And we've been reading it ever since, for about 4 hours. I'm not sure anybody has read it word for word, but we've made some pretty good progress. All the materials total 448 pages, and the report itself is divided into two volumes. Volume 1 details Russian interference in the 2016 election and the Trump campaign's contact with Russians during and after the campaign. Volume 2 details the results of the special counsel's investigation into any obstruction of justice by President Trump. So we're going to talk about the findings in both volumes, the manner in which the report was released, and the politics of what comes next. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
Good. I focused on volume one.
Everyone else
was like volume two. I'm like a contrarian man. So
I read some volume one. I think Amelia did too.
Volume one's actually the better volume.
Also with us is senior politics writer Clay Malone. How's it going?
It's good. Do I have to say what volume I focused on?
Yeah, what volume did you focus on?
I focused on volume two, obstruction, because I thought that was the real question at hand.
All right. Also with us is senior writer Perry Beacon Jr. How are you doing, Perry?
I was a volume two person as well.
All right. Good to hear. And also with us is senior writer Amelia Thompson DeVoe. Amelia, how are you?
I'm good. I made a valiant effort to read both volumes.
All right. I like that. And also, listeners, in case you noticed the title change to senior writer, Amelia Thompson DeVoe is now officially with 538 full time. So congratulations, Amelia.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I'm excited.
What a great first podcast to be with us full time for.
Yeah, baptism by fire.
It was the official demise of Mueller talk, though, I think, which is sad.
Well, you know, apparently he's going to testify, so...
That's true.
I shouldn't speak too soon.
Mueller lives.
So I have some specific questions that I want to get to, but we've all been digging into different parts of the report throughout the day, and I'm sure everyone has their own top line conclusions that they want to talk about. So let's begin there. And Amelia, what's your top line takeaway from the Mueller report?
There are kind of two big takeaways. As you mentioned, the report is in two volumes, very official. And the first volume was about the investigation that was sort of the original focus for Mueller, which was Russian interference in the 2016 election. And there, Mueller basically concluded that although there was a lot of contact between members of the Trump campaign and various people with Russian government affiliations, there was not sufficient evidence to prove that the campaign was involved in some kind of criminal conspiracy or criminal coordination with Russia. So there's a lot more in that volume, but that's kind of the big top line takeaway. And then we get to the second part, which is about whether President Trump obstructed justice related to the Russia investigations. And this is interesting because we had sort of had this cliffhanger when Attorney General William Barr last month released his sort of summary and interpretation of what he thought were the kind of top line conclusions of the Mueller report. And it wasn't clear from that. We knew that Mueller hadn't come to a conclusion about whether Trump obstructed justice. What we got today was this sort of explanation from Mueller that he had really been following the Department of Justice policy, a longstanding policy that says you can't indict a sitting president. And so he writes pointedly that the report doesn't exonerate Trump and that he basically sort of started with the assumption that he can't charge Trump while he's still president. And so he can't come to a conclusion. He couldn't apply a criminal framework mm-hmm. to figure out if the evidence would have warranted a criminal charge. And that's different from the way that Barr has been framing it. So that's the big takeaway there.
Claire, I know that you have been digging into volume two today. How much evidence was there of obstruction of justice?
Not to put myself in the position of a special counsel making declarations, which obviously he didn't for a number of reasons. I mean, Mueller lays out quite a lot of evidence that could be used to say in sort of what he calls a heartland obstruction of justice case, or basically like a run-of-the-mill obstruction of justice case, that there's a lot of evidence that Trump probably did obstruct justice. I would point out that, you know, the firing of Comey, which was the ostensible reason for Mueller's initial appointment, I think he comes to a pretty, I think that when you read those sections, you come to a pretty fair conclusion, I'd say, that, or my interpretation of it, is that the president did obstruct justice. And there's some interesting stuff in the report towards the end where they basically try to lay out all this sort of swirling stuff about, can he have obstructed justice? And he says, and they say, if the likely effect of the acts is to intimidate witnesses or alter their testimony, the justice system's integrity is equally threatened. And that's kind of referencing Trump's position, great position of power as the head of the executive branch, because Mueller points out that there's a lot of stuff that he does have constitutional powers to do, but he also sort of seems to indicate here that he can also use that position of authority, as he puts, to corrupt corrupt efforts, to use his official powers to curtail and or interfere with an investigation.
So he essentially lays out all of this evidence. There are 10 or 11 different incidences that he describes, and then says, from the beginning, I couldn't make a conclusion about whether all of this evidence amounts to obstruction of justice because I wasn't going to be able to indict the sitting president anyway, so I never even tried.
Yeah, to be clear to people who haven't read the report, which was probably a lot of you listening, that's our job. Yeah, he does. There are basically these 10, I think 11 is our official ABC News count, but he'll, you know, say, here's the subheading for what the potential, what the situation was, you know, whether it be firing Comey or trying to get McGahn to get Sessions to resign. And then he'll do kind of, here's what happened based on all the interviews we've done. Here's the closeness to the nexus of obstruction, and here's our analysis of the situation, and here's our analysis of the intent, so which is important for the obstruction charge.
I'm sure this is something we'll come back to, but I also want to touch on Volume 1. Mm-hmm. Nate, what was your top-line takeaway from reading Volume 1?
So Volume 1 is about the alleged acts of not collusion, that's not the term that Mueller prefers, but coordination.
Or conspiracy.
Conspiracy. And I don't know, the analogy I made is that you get the sense that the Trump campaign and Russia are like two kind of college students or teenagers like kind of flirting over the course of a drunken evening where at one point, well, there's a lot of flirting, at one point they're making out or something, but they kind of go their separate ways. It's a little messy. There might be some desire or intent to hook up. It doesn't quite happen that way. You can imagine if they had different itineraries, they might wind up having hooked up, right? But like, yeah, Russia kind of reached out, and at times, people on the Trump campaign were open and receptive to those invitations. At times, they were not, right? But nothing kind of came to like a criminal conspiracy. At the same time, he does lay out several things that, in kind of ordinary speech, you might call coordination, right? There was this Trump Tower meeting where this Russian woman kind of comes and says, hey, I have dirt on Hillary Clinton. Can we like talk about maybe removing the Magnitsky Act? And it seems like she was kind of a little bit full of it. Maybe it was an effort to like establish coordination, but she didn't actually like really have any dirt. It's not clear whether Trump himself is informed of this. Mueller says that Michael Cohen says that Trump was aware of it. But Mueller sounds a little bit skeptical of Michael Cohen there, and other people say that Trump wasn't aware of it. Maybe the closest thing to a smoking gun, and this has all been reported, right, or a lot of it has been reported, is that Paul Manafort gave confidential polling data and other information about the campaign strategy to his one of his Russian contacts, and a Russian contact who was believed to have been in touch with the Russian intelligence agencies. And so Mueller is like, so I'm not really sure, this is Mueller, why Manafort gave this polling data to them. It may have been just that Manafort was trying to like curry favor with him and trying to win over an influential patron, but we're not sure his motivation. We can't really trust anything Manafort says because Manafort lied about it. And we're also not really sure kind of what became of this information, which among other things said that the Trump campaign was making a big play for the upper Midwest. So Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, Pennsylvania, which proved to be at least three of those four critical states in Trump's victory. And so it's not like, I don't know, it's not as though they aren't detailing a lot of kind of peripheral, even more than peripheral, interactions between the Trump campaign and Russia. It's not as though Mueller is batting down a bunch of things that was reported by the media. With one exception, he does seem pretty confident that efforts to change the GOP platform on policy toward Ukraine, Mueller seems pretty sure that that had nothing to do with any Trump-Russian interference. But for the most part, he is saying there's all the stuff that was reported, you know, occurred as reported. There's maybe nothing beyond that, really. You know, again, for me, I think if the campaign manager is passing polling data to a Russian national who is in contact with Russian intelligence agencies, I mean, that sounds like it could maybe be pretty close to some C word.
Yeah, that was a very striking part of the report. And let me just quote from it so people have an idea of what conclusions Mueller actually came to. It says, on August 2nd, 2016, Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort met in New York City with his longtime business associate, Konstantin Kalimnik, who the FBI assesses to have ties with Russian intelligence. Kalimnik requested the meeting to deliver in person a peace plan for Ukraine that Manafort acknowledged to the special counsel's office was a backdoor way for Russia to control part of eastern Ukraine. Both men believed the plan would require candidate Trump's assent to succeed were he to be elected president. They also discussed the status of the Trump campaign and Manafort's strategy for winning Democratic votes in Midwestern states. Months before that meeting, Manafort had caused internal polling data to be shared with Kalimnik, and the sharing continued for some period of time after their August meeting. So that's all directly from the report.
Let me bring up one more point, which I think, you know, deserves some emphasis because it is relevant to how the conclusion about obstruction bears on the conclusion about coordination, right? Which is at one point early in the report, Mueller says, although based on what the best determination that we can make based on the evidence we have in hand, there's nothing that reaches the level of criminal conspiracy. And I don't think he's like, oh, it's on the brink of conspiracy, but not quite. I think he says, like, we're like, you know, some yardage removed from conspiracy. But he also says that, you know, the whole situation could be cast in a different light, including the overall conclusion, if there had not been efforts to withhold information from us. And of course, Manafort is the one who the cooperation agreement was breached, and Manafort's the nexus where it seems clearest, both in terms of his longtime relationships with Russia and in terms of this polling data that he shared. And so you cannot completely separate out Section 1 and Section 2.
All right, Perry, thank you for hanging on for a moment there. I want to get to you. What were your top line conclusions from reading the report today?
The most important thing I thought was a lot of what I read I had already read before. In the report, in a lot of ways, confirms the media reporting of the last 2 years. There wasn't evidence that Donald Trump, you know, say called Vladimir Putin and said, you know, hack John Podesta's email on July 13th. But there was a lot of contacts and so on between the Russian government, between Russian affiliated officials and Trump campaign officials, but not enough to prove some kind of like collusion, which is not really a legal term. And then the second part, what jumped out at me was there were a few. I knew a lot of the obstructionist things that had happened, particularly the firing Comey section was very familiar to me. But there was a section about, you know, basically Trump telling Corey Lewandowski, who had been his campaign manager, to basically give Jeff Sessions a bunch of instructions and tell Jeff Sessions basically to unrecuse himself, get involved in the investigation, and so on. So there were some new details in the sort of obstruction section that were important. Mueller in the second, the volume two, goes out of his way to say there's been an argument from Trump's attorneys that basically, you know, as long as Trump is doing something that is in his official duties, you know, basically he can't obstruct justice in his official duties. So in other words, the Comey firing is not obstruction in any circumstances because the president is allowed to fire the FBI director. So Mueller goes in great detail to reject this idea and say, yes, in fact, the president can obstruct justice. And then, of course, the conclusion of the report is very important in that the end of volume two is the Mueller's office says, essentially, if we could show that Trump did not obstruct justice, we would say so. We expressly are saying we cannot prove that. So they're basically saying there's a lot of evidence he obstructed, and we're not going to say he didn't, which, you know, which in other words, like, you know, if Barr had included that sentence and that framing in his initial letter, I think that would have been very different than what you heard. In other words, I would argue that what we saw today was not surprising, but it was certainly a lot worse for Trump than the letter and the press conference from Attorney General Barr were.
Yeah, that was my really big takeaway, is just the Barr press conference this morning, the Barr framing previously, is really misleading. And let me just read for people what Perry was talking about from the report. Under that framework, we concluded Article 2 of the Constitution does not categorically and permanently immunize the president from potential liability for the conduct that we investigated. And as we said earlier, they laid out a lot of conduct that probably falls under obstruction.
Amelia, looking at this, I know Claire basically said, I'm not the special counsel, and I know you're not the special counsel either. But in looking at all of that evidence, do you feel comfortable saying whether or not it seemed like the president obstructed justice?
I wouldn't go that far, but I would say I was surprised. The thing that really surprised me in the second section of the report was sort of how clearly and directly the special counsel and his team were comfortable saying, we know what the president intended here. We have some good evidence that we can sort of say through, you know, make some inferences about he did these other things, he said these other things. We know, or we have a good sense for why he did what he did. And that has always been one of the big questions, because Trump was never actually interviewed by the special counsel. And there's sort of an interesting side part of the report where they're sort of saying, you know, they got these written answers from Trump. They, you know, they didn't like them. They felt they were inadequate, but they basically had so much evidence that they didn't push for it and sort of head into what would have basically been a kind of long constitutional battle about whether they could subpoena the president or try to get him to compel him to sit for an interview, because they felt like they had what they needed. And so, you know, there are certainly moments where, you know, the special counsel's team will say, you know, here's an episode of potentially obstructive behavior, and oh, maybe, you know, it wasn't obstructive because it couldn't have directly affected the investigation, or, you know, it's sort of not clear what his intent was there, if his intent was to obstruct the investigation. But there were a lot of moments where they were making pretty clear and direct statements that Trump seemed to be doing the things he was doing because he was trying to interfere with the Russia investigation. And that was really striking, especially in contrast with the way that Barr framed it this morning, where he was basically saying, you know, you have to understand the situation that Trump was facing. He was coming into office, he was being criticized by the media, he was under investigation. And basically, I don't think Trump had corrupt motivations when he was taking these actions. And so I think both the directness of the special counsel's report at certain points, and then also the contrast with Barr is really striking.
All right, I want to continue this conversation in just a minute, but before we do, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. And that place is ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Casper Mattress. Warmer weather is finally here, and that means it's time for spring cleaning. You could spend time sprucing up the house and yard, but if you really want a fresh start, get a Casper mattress. From mattresses and pillows to sheets and duvets, Casper transforms the way you sleep and will help you wake up feeling refreshed and ready to fully enjoy this beautiful weather. The Casper mattress combines 4 layers of pressure-relieving foams for all-night comfort. It's softer under your shoulders and firmer under your hips for healthy alignment and extra support. Plus, the breathable foams are designed to keep you cool at night. With bedding, bed frames, and even a dog bed, Casper has everything you need to create the perfect sleep environment. You also get free shipping and free returns on all mattress orders, so you can try Casper by sleeping on it for 100 nights risk-free. You'll love sleeping on a Casper mattress. Go to Casper.com and use code POLITICS for $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. That's Casper.com, code POLITICS, and get $100 towards the purchase of select mattresses. Additional fees may apply for Alaska and Hawaii. Terms and conditions apply. That's Casper.com, code POLITICS. All right, let's continue our conversation. And Amelia, I want to ask one other legal question of you. We said that in the report in volume one, it says pretty clearly that there was not an illegal conspiracy or illegal coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia. How big of a gap was there? Like, what would the Trump campaign have had to do in order for it to cross that threshold into an illegal conspiracy or illegal coordination?
I mean, obviously, the Mueller team's not saying, like, here's the width of the gap between, like, what the Trump campaign did and what it would take. But the definition that Mueller was operating under was fairly narrow. It was basically that the Trump campaign and Russia had to agree that they were going to interfere with the election. And that, of course, doesn't cover all of this sort of, you know, mushier stuff that Nate was describing. So I do think it's important to note that kind of, you know, this is a criminal investigation. Mueller's a prosecutor. He had to make a legal determination. And the way that he was sort of, you know, the way that he was thinking about these possible violations was quite specific.
Let's get to the rollout of this report over the past month or so and the political implications now. We talked about Barr's initial summary. We talked about his press conference this morning. Do you guys think he was successful at blunting the effect of this report?
No.
No.
I think he was somewhere between unsuccessful and it probably backfiring. So first of all, public opinion did not move in Trump's favor after the Barr letter was released, which you might have expected it to do. Second of all, I think, like, to sound really dorky about it, this is a multi-stage game in, like, a game theory sense where you can react to someone else's strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Barr tried a one-time move, which is, like, Barr is seen as credible. He was attorney general under the first Bush, been around D.C. a long time. And so he's not seen as, like, a crazy Trump person. He's seen as someone who is one of the good old guys who will spin, but within kind of the traditional D.C. / media / White House rules of spin. And he went beyond that. I mean, he went, like, to about the most you can spin this without it just being flatly a lie. It's on the verge between spin.
Yeah, he really walked up to the lie.
Yeah, which is, you know, more than I think most people would have expected. But the way that you had reports trickling out that, first of all, they kind of stonewalled on when were they going to release the report, and they did eventually release it a month or so later, or less than a month later, right, like 3 weeks later, which is not so bad. But when you began to hear people who worked on the investigation complain to the Times and the Post, that was a pretty bad sign. And then this press conference this morning, I felt like was kind of an unforced error, frankly, because, like, that really was just explicitly an attempt at spin, and there was some spin about what the spin was going to be, and the spin was, oh, it's just a matter to, like, lay out some parameters of what's contained in the report and blah, 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 and provide context. And instead, it was a very explicit attempt at spin and kind of a very combative press conference to the point where, you know, I think the media feels like they were at least mildly fooled the first time around. So to, like, reinsert Barr as a character there, and in contrast to this report that, I mean, let me back up. If we read the Mueller report today without the Barr letter, I think it would have been straight down the fairway of what we expected. Neither better or worse from Trump than reasonable expectations. And I think those expectations were that, yes, on conspiracy, there's more smoke than fire. On obstruction, there's a fair amount of fire. I think that's what you would have expected if you were not only watching MSNBC or something, like actually reading a comprehensive and high quality set of news coverage about the Mueller report and the investigation. And in fact, if you go to prediction markets, which we cite probably too often on the podcast, they have the odds that Trump will survive his full 4-year term. They actually reverted today like 78%, which is exactly where they were before the Barr letter.
And so where did they go after the Barr letter?
So it went from like 78 to like 88, and now they're back to 78. Okay. I don't know which number is right. 78 sounds a little low to me, frankly, but it's almost like we reverted back to where expectations were beforehand, and Barr, I think, didn't do any good in terms of perceptions, except he cost himself credibility and made it very clear that he's a partisan, and I think he'll be treated that way by people in the press who felt a little burned because they had this whole narrative about, oh, did the media jump to conclusions? Ironically, the media jumped to conclusions based on this 4-page letter, and I think it kind of frames the report in a way that's a little bit worse. I mean, there's a question about, like, what was Barr's goal here? Maybe Barr's goal was to please Trump, and it was not necessarily to optimally kind of control the message. But I was surprised by, and you can go back and listen to our podcast after the Barr letter, right? You know, I kind of thought that they were going to engage in some spin, but not quite this much spin. I mean, I'm not totally shocked, but it's a ballsy effort, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, Perry, in terms of, you know, how this is received politically, Nate says that it backfired, but also at the same time that things sort of reverted to the mean. How are you processing the effect that all this spin had on the report's reception?
Yeah, I think Nate is right that the media coverage today will probably be worse than it would have been if the report had just come out, because now people feel as if Barr lied to us, you know, and was, you know, if not lied, was misleading and a little vague. And then the press conference today, in which we're going to have a press conference about a report that we're not going to let you read, was also, like, as a reporter, just kind of irritating and disingenuous. So I think that's not going to, like, help Barr. And it does, and I think for the rest of his term, you know, like Nate said, Barr came in, he had some credibility, he wasn't someone who worked in the Trump campaign, he wasn't known as a Trump loyalist, but now I think he will be known in that context as someone who, the press conference today definitely felt like someone who was looking to defend Trump and be praised by Trump and to kind of be in Trump's inner circle.
So Trump's approval rating didn't improve after the initial Barr summary. Is there any reason then to expect that his standing would worsen with the American public now that the full report is out?
I don't think so. I tend to think that, you know, we've had a lot of events the last 2 years, and basically we see a stability. Trump is approved by between 37 and 42 at times of the public, and those numbers have some difference, obviously. And then the disapproval is a majority, 53, 55, something like that. I don't see a big change in that. What I am curious to see is, like, what do you do if you're Nancy Pelosi? Because this report, in a lot of ways, basically says Mueller and DOJ can't prosecute the president, but Congress does have a role here. And he basically, you know, wrote a report and handed it to Pelosi, who said no impeachment before. But I think there's got to be some gap between no impeachment and nothing. And I'll be curious sort of what Pelosi says and what she does next, because this report did bring a lot to her doorstep.
You know, one thing I didn't see, though, I follow all the damn Democratic candidates on Twitter. I don't think I saw any of them commenting.
I did.
Okay. Well, thanks for undermining my... Yeah.
That's what I'm here for, Nate.
Thank you, Claire.
Call out that punditry when she sees it.
Swalwell? He doesn't count.
I saw Buttigieg.
Oh, Pete, Mayor Pete? Okay.
Yeah.
So what has the political reaction been across the board that you've noticed so far?
I mean, I think Trump defenders are fairly quiet.
I mean... Maybe the ones you're following.
Well, Nate should finish his point, but his campaign, we should note, did send out one of those no exoneration emails.
Yeah, I've been seeing, you know, Jim Jordan saying no collusion, no obstruction,
okay, but to be
total
frank,
exoneration.
To be frank, the people who are explicitly paid by Trump, like Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Kellyanne Conway, to spin and lie, you know, we're happy to spin.
Which, and that's like not the, necessarily slander now, because apparently Sarah Huckabee Sanders admitted to investigators that she did lie. So there you go. Sorry, continue your point now.
When the Barr letter came out, I think there were some never-Trumpers who were like, you know what, I'm not a big fan of Trump, but I think this kind of Russia thing went too far. You didn't see a lot of that today, I don't think. You know, you had messages from vulnerable Republican senators like Susan Collins saying, I look forward to digging into this whole report and learning more about the truth of the matter potentially. I mean, look, in some ways, both sides are kind of maybe playing it for a draw. Where in the status quo pre-Barr letter, then the fact that this Russian investigation is going on is one of many reasons maybe why Trump's approval rating is at 42% despite a good economy and not 51% or whatever. Maybe not the only or the most important reason. In fact, the evidence shows voters don't care that much about Russia. But it's priced in as a negative about Trump. And maybe kind of both sides play it for a draw in the sense that, like, clearly, if you want to actually get like a PR win from this that convinces someone apart from the 41 or 42%, you would not go about spinning the report in this way that to anyone with half a brain cell who's not a total partisan recognizes is spin and misleading, especially when you do actually have some very good parts of the report. I mean, the report, it's correct to say the report does not conclude that there is enough evidence to charge a criminal conspiracy against Trump. That's not a super high bar, but it's a medium bar, and he cleared it, and that's a pretty nice win. He He also got away, although he apparently did want to fire Mueller. He got away without firing Mueller or screwing things up in that way. So it's almost like the compromise is that he is not going to get a win out of this, but he does remove some like acute danger of like, what if they did find efforts to collude?
On the political front of what Democrats might do with the Mueller report stuff, we should note that Jerry Nadler said that he wanted Mueller to testify before the Judiciary Committee before, what, May 23rd, something like mm-hmm. that. And I'm on Kamala Harris's Twitter page. She's got a fundraising action pinned to the top of her feed that says, if you agree with me that we need the full unredacted Mueller report and we need Mueller to testify before Congress, you know, click here and give me money. So I think that those are kind of like, that's a candidate reaction, right? And to me, that's sort of whatever that iteration is for the next year and a half could kind of be how Democrats approach the Mueller report stuff.
But have you seen people arguing for impeachment?
No, not impeachment.
Yeah, Amelia, can you weigh in here? I mean, what do you expect Democrats to do with this report? And would you expect that their rhetoric about impeachment would change?
Well, it's interesting because the story that Mueller is telling in the second half of the report, which is basically the president sort of repeatedly doing different things to interfere with an ongoing criminal investigation, insofar as impeachment is a remedy that's designed to remove a president who is at risk of causing imminent harm to the country. That could be an argument for saying that, you know, a president who's willing to meddle in a criminal investigation like that, you know, I could see a Democrat, if they wanted to, making that argument. Whether that is a good argument for them to make is another thing, because of course we know that the House of Representatives can vote to impeach Trump and then he has to be removed by the Senate. And so it's sort of, maybe they have a stronger case to argue for impeachment if they want to, but who is it going to convince?
And that gets to the Republican reaction. Perry, I know you've been following potential primary challengers to Trump and also Republican reactions to Trump across the board. What have you seen throughout the day?
It's broken along sort of what I thought it would, which is like people like obviously the House Freedom Caucus, Trump campaign officials, people who are very close to Trump are saying exoneration, the investigation is crazy. We need to investigate the investigators now. That wasn't surprising to me. And you've seen, I think Susan Collins, I think Nate referred to it, had a statement that was along the lines of, you know, encouraging Mueller to testify and sort of saying this was a good process and she's glad Mueller was able to finish the probe. So that's kind of probably the most kind of quote unquote liberal reaction we'll probably get from a Republican member of Congress. I haven't seen a lot from people like Senator McConnell, people like Senator Blunt. The sort of like mainstream Republicans, I haven't seen a ton from yet that has been very clear. And I think I'll be curious to see what over the next day, like they're not going to obviously call for anything negative towards Trump, but I'll be curious how far they go in defending him and how far they go. I assume if you're McConnell, you don't want necessarily Barr to launch a probe of Obama, DOJ and James Comey and so on. I think you want, if you're McConnell, I think you want this to go away and for Trump to just stop talking about it. But I'd be curious to see if McConnell sort of hints in that direction directly or not. And because I think for the Republicans, just having this story kind of go away is the best thing for them. And maybe Mueller testifies and that's the end of the story. But that would involve Trump kind of not wanting to sort of have retribution for this. And I doubt, and I don't know what his instincts are. I feel like he wants to sort of get a payback from this. And I'll be curious to how Republicans react to that.
Yeah, as far as any, you know, primary challenges are concerned, of course, Bill Weld is going all in on this report in case anybody was interested. But people like Nikki Haley, who I think we set as the bar for, you know, that's the person that Trump needs to worry about as far as any primary challenges are concerned. This is what she had to say, quote, "You can have as many people testify as you want, but it won't change the outcome. The question that should be asked is on what basis was the FISA warrant issued and who knew about it? The American people deserve to know the truth since they paid for this investigation." So she's more going back to how did this investigation originate now that we have the conclusion and it doesn't say that there was a criminal conspiracy. Let's figure out how this investigation came to be. A pretty pro-Trump response.
Yeah, and to what Perry said and what Galen is saying now, reading the Nikki Haley stuff, I mean, the Trump campaign has sent out two emails this afternoon that make calls to turn the tables and to investigate Democrats. and they are fundraising emails. So again, to bring this back to how will the two parties handle this in sort of the 2020 vein of things, they're going to fundraise off of it from partisans who are, you know, pissed off in either direction.
All right. Well, I'll say that we're probably going to be covering the fallout from this report for a bit. This will not be our last podcast about the contents or the reactions to the report. But I want to wrap up by giving each of you an opportunity to share your closing thoughts. Nate, let's start with you.
I do think this is probably going to be the beginning of a slow wind down.
Wind down of what?
Of coverage of the... Because again, like, in some sense, all sides can be like weirdly satisfied with this outcome, right? The Democrats can be satisfied knowing that very few swing voters are going to be convinced anymore by no collusion, no obstruction, at least the latter part, that even when you had Barr's spin dominating the conversation, it didn't move public opinion in Trump's favor at all. And it's one of these priced in negatives, and Trump has a lot of negatives about his campaign for 2020. Conversely, Republicans move a lot of downside risk from the table. Again, the risk that Trump would actually fire Mueller, which I think would blow up public opinion a lot, or the risk that you'd have definitive findings of collusion, for example. And so, you know, the Democratic candidates of 2020, I mean, Pete Buttigieg, Claire was alerting me to his statement. The Mueller report is a disturbing, if not completely surprising, collection of evidence that shows a president putting his own interests ahead of the country's. Today, again, demonstrates why we need to change the channel in 2020. So Buttigieg is saying, hey, look, this is a 2020 issue. We'll litigate this over the course of the campaign. It's one reason, one of many reasons he's implying not to vote for Trump and to have a new president, right? And that is kind of how I think the Democratic messaging will go. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there'll be some people in the Democratic caucus who are calling for impeachment proceedings. It sure seems like Nancy Pelosi has had a good 4 months as head of the Democratic Party and would prevent that. And I think probably knows, like, this is not what voters want to hear about. And if you kind of overplay your hand, right? I guess all I'm saying, the phrase, it's like a chess term called, like, zugzwang or something.
Oh my God.
Where, let me look that up. Where, like, whoever makes the next move loses. And so you want to just kind of sit back. Zugzwang. I think we're at a stalemate because any move another side makes will result in their overplaying their hand and probably backfire.
We all know American politics is just like high-level chess.
All right, Claire, what are your thoughts wrapping up?
Just very quickly, I mean, I haven't read the full report. I've read a decent amount of it, and I don't know if this will bubble down or, you know, trickle down to the general public, but I will say it is striking to read these accounts of people who basically were requested by the president to do things that they felt either morally or ethically uncomfortable with, and they didn't do those things. It is a fascinating insight into a dysfunctional White House. And, you know, I think that Mueller does lay out some sort of obstruction-like things. So at the very, my read of it, just going through it, is just there is a lot of stuff that is dysfunctional about this White House.
Can I add a little bit of context? This is breaking news off the Twitter. So Steny Hoyer, House Majority Leader, says, based on what you have seen to date, going forward on impeachment is not worthwhile at this point. There will be an election in 18 months. The American people will make a judgment.
Yeah.
And so that's an official statement coming in the last 20 minutes from when we're taping this and seems pretty definitive on, no, we're not going to pursue impeachment.
All right. Perry, your thoughts?
So, yeah, I assumed impeachment wasn't happening. I do think there is a... So we have a report detailing basically that the president in a lot of ways asks his staff regularly to do things that are either illegal or close to illegal or legally dubious. So the president has now cleared out the Department of Homeland Security, their hierarchy, and there's been a lot of reporting that he is asking the people in the department to take legally dubious or maybe illegal steps to stop immigrants from entering the country. So the Democrats may not want to impeach, but I think the idea that they can talk about health care the next 2 years is probably also not likely either. Like, the president is continuing to go in a direction of doing things that are legally questionable, and that unfortunately is like where the Congress is. That's sort of their job, and so they're going to have to get in that, because it looks like Trump is not going to, like, what you saw in that report is what Trump did in the investigation about Mueller, but it's also kind of how Trump generally behaves, which is that he sort of seems to be asking subordinates to do things that are legally dubious regularly, and there's going to be a lot of reporting congressional examination of those trends. I guess the other thing I wanted to say is, just as a person who's in the media, this is my profession, so it was important to see, like, as much as we've, you know, I criticized the media some, there was a lot of criticism, you know, Trump has obviously suggested the whole investigation was fake news. We basically had 400 pages of things that I read in the New York Times and the Washington Post, to their credit, on ABC News, NBC News. The media, you know, probed this story and found a lot of things that were later confirmed by the investigation. So I think I want to at least applaud a lot of the reporting here, which was important, and more importantly, ended up being true about what happened here.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about Democrats not being able to solely talk about healthcare for the next year and a half or so, because after the Barr summary did come out, I think Micah, well, he's not here to defend himself, but was making the point like, hey, this could be good for Democrats and that they're going to put this all behind them and they can talk about kitchen table issues for the rest of the 2020 campaign. We'll see what ends up happening. Maybe Micah's right. Maybe you're right, Perry. But in any case, Amelia, we'll give you the final word.
Oh, thank you. That's a lot of pressure. So I was struck by a couple things, like Perry and Claire. I mean, just the portrait of what was happening in the White House is fascinating. I was fascinated by it. And I mean, it's really striking, you know, that section of the report was not good for the president. And certainly having this opinion in place saying that a federal prosecutor can't indict a sitting president appears to have helped Trump a lot. Also, the fact that a lot of Trump's staff just refused to do the things he told them to do really kept him out of being in a worse position legally here. So, yes, insofar as other people are leaving the administration, that's sort of it's kind of telling, I think, for just what's going on inside Trump's administration and what happens if you don't have those people kind of serving as a buffer. And then I guess just the last thing that I was thinking about as I was going through the report is there actually wasn't, you know, we got a lot of information about what Mueller thought about Trump's motives on the obstruction of justice stuff, but we don't know as much about people's motives otherwise, especially around the Russia findings, and especially why everyone was lying about it. And that just seems like it's still kind of an open question. And I don't know if we're ever going to get an answer to it, but it was sort of something that was always in the back of my head is, you know, just there are just a lot of people with connections to Russia and a lot of people not telling the truth about those connections with Russia, even when questioned by federal investigators. And that's not really something we got much of an answer to from this report.
And it's probably worth mentioning here as well, as we talk about whether or not this will continue to dominate at least parts of the news cycle, is that in the report they said 14 separate investigations came out of this initial special counsel investigation, only two of which are currently publicly known. So there are 12 other investigations going on that came out of this in some way or another that we don't know about and we may find out about eventually or not.
Right. Yes. Maybe not. Stay tuned.
And I think that's where we'll leave things. Some things we now know, other things I guess we'll have to wait and see. And again, I'm sure that this is not the last podcast we'll do on these topics. But for now, thank you, Nate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Amelia.
Thank you.
And again, congratulations on joining us on a full-time basis. We're happy to have you.
Thanks so much. Thrilled to be here.
That's Nate clapping into his microphone. And also, I'll remind folks that we are going to be doing some live shows in Texas. There are still tickets for our show in Houston on May 8th. If you want to grab some tickets, go to 538.com/live. We'll see you there. We'll all be wearing cowboy boots, of course, right? Have you picked out your cowboy boots yet, Claire?
Yes.
Awesome. I have yet to pick them out. Nate, we can pick out those together.
Okay. I'm looking forward to not wearing cowboy boots.
Cowboy boots are surprisingly expensive, people.
Yeah.
They're also very comfortable, though.
Maybe there'll be a corp card expense for our Texas live show.
Okay, you can't. The grift can't occur on the podcast. You have to.
All right. And with that, my name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon.